Consumer Affairs Committee, and good afternoon. How do you like the swing shift?
I don't.
I never like swing shift.
Open the public hearing on House Bill 3363.
Can we get time?
Janet?
Yeah.
Pardon? Can we get time and a half?
Yeah, right. I don't know, take it up to the Labor Commissioner. Janet, can you give us a summary of what 3363 does?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3363 establishes minimum efficiency standards for specific commercial electrical appliances that applies the standards to sales and installation of new appliances over time. There's a list in of appliances that beginning in 2007 that the state would prohibit the sale of new commercial clothes washers, commercial pre-rinse spray valves, commercial refrigerators or freezers, digital television adapters, lighted exit signs, external power supplies, incandescent reflector lamps, and certain traffic and lighting features unless they meet the standards in the bill. Then beginning in 2008, it would prohibit the installation of the same commercial appliances unless they meet the standards. And finally, beginning in 2009, it would prohibit the installation of two additional appliances, commercial ice cube machines and metal halide lamp fixtures, unless they meet the efficiency standards. It exempts the sales of new appliances that if they're manufactured in the state but sold outside the state, and also exempts installations in mobile homes or manufactured homes or recreational vehicles. There's an additional requirement that by 2010, the State Department of Energy review and update these minimum efficiency standards. And gives a criteria they'll use to do that. Mr. Chair, it requires manufacturers to test their products and to certify their compliance, and it specifies progressive sanctions for violations. Thank you, Mr. Chair. These are appliances for which there are currently no federal efficiency standards.
Okay, thank you, Janet. Representative Dingfelder, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It is my pleasure to be here, and I really appreciate you taking the time to hear this very exciting bill. I know you can't wait to hear more about these appliances. For the record, my name is Jackie Dingfelder. I'm state representative from House District 45, Northeast Portland. And unfortunately, my colleagues and co-sponsors, Representative Jensen and Senator Atkinson, cannot be here today, so I am carrying all this weight on my shoulders myself, but we have some excellent people here.
Did they cough out on you?
They had other commitments. They're very busy people.
Okay.
They are very supportive of this bill, obviously, because they are chief co-sponsors. But you are going to hear from some certified smart people here today that can explain the details far better than I can, but what I'm going to do is provide an overview of why I signed on to this most excellent bill and sponsored it. As you know, this bill presents some excellent opportunities to save electricity, water, natural gas, and money right here in Oregon. And this bill develops standards for 12 appliances, and I think you should have packages in front of you that include all the information about these appliances, which I'm sure you will read very carefully. But these standards that you see in the bill have already been adopted in the state of California. And since California is one of the economies that drives the marketplace nationally, there's no reason not to ensure Oregonians can benefit from energy-efficient appliances as well. Also, the state of Washington has passed a similar bill in both the House and the Senate, and it's currently in conference committee, and it's expected to be signed by the governor next week. Their session is wrapping up. I know we're all jealous about that, but so hopefully this will be signed into law shortly in Washington. So we have the opportunity here in Oregon to have consistent standards. We adopt this bill, we'll have consistent standards among the West Coast. So what this bill does, it sets, as I mentioned, similar standards in California in order to create a unified market among the three West Coast states. Only 12 products are covered in this bill, but even just with those 12 appliances, this bill would save enough electricity to power 50,000 homes and save up to 1 billion gallons of water by 2014. In addition, natural gas annual savings of 3% could be realized, and through the natural gas annual savings, it could be 3% of statewide commercial consumption of natural gas. All of those are significant numbers. Although the California standards covered more products than what's currently in House Bill 3363, there were specific criteria used to determine which appliances to include here in Oregon. So I'm just going to walk through those criteria so you understand how did these 12 items appear in this bill. First, we looked at requiring or having a rapid financial return to buyers. We felt that was very important. Products covered by the bill have a very short payback period. The longest payback period is about 3.5 years for LED traffic signals. Number two, multiple manufacturers are already producing products that meet or exceed these standards that are outlined in the bill. Third, the standards results in savings that are meaningful in the Northwest. California standards included some products that either are not in widespread use in the Northwest or would not result in significant savings. Fourth, the existence of benefits in addition to economic and environmental are key. As an example, the standard for torchiere floor lamps, you know those floor lamps that are really bright and they can brighten up a whole room. The lamp, this has been an issue as far as fire safety, and so the standards set in this bill would prevent the use of the hot halogen bulbs that have started more than 290 fires, resulting in several deaths. So this is also a consumer aspect of this bill, consumer protection. And then last but certainly not least, we are also looking at significant water savings, and of course you all know that's near and dear to my heart. Given that this is going to be a very low water year, and we've already seen drought conditions issued in several counties throughout Oregon. So we're looking at some potential for significant water savings in addition to the energy, the electricity, and the natural gas. All of the standards proposed in this bill will not be implemented. I want to emphasize they will not be implemented until they are already in place in California. The standards only apply to new products purchased after January 1, 2008. This will prevent manufacturers from being stuck with stranded merchandise, because we're concerned about that, obviously. Also, the bill does not require any consumer to replace an older but still functioning product. One final note, we have enacted the technical standards in state law, as you probably noticed and might have wondered why that's so. For a couple reasons. One is to ensure that Oregon standards are consistent with California's and other states, and two, to reduce costs to the state by removing the need to undertake rulemaking to adopt these technical standards. So I once again thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for your interest in this bill. You're going to hear from many other experts in this issue, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative. Where are these plants manufactured? Are they manufactured in the United States, or most of them imported?
I believe that most of them are manufactured in the United States, but I'm probably not the best person to answer for every single appliance. We do have a couple of representatives here today that are going to speak about some amendments that they're proposing, but the majority are within the United States. But the Department of Energy is here, and I know that they would like to come up and speak on the bill, and they may be able to identify for each if it's not already in your packet.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. And I look forward to working with you on this bill.
Okay. Thank you. Again. Could I have Mike Greeny and Jeff Bezanet?
Mr. Chair. While they're coming up, Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce for the record a letter from the Northwest Power Planning Council that should have been in your packets that were distributed, and notice that it's signed by former Senator Joan Dukes.
Okay.
And the Northwest Power Planning Council is in support of the bill.
Thank you, Jen.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Mike Greeny. I'm director of the Department of Energy. And on my left is Charlie Stevens, who's a senior policy analyst and has done a lot of work for us on energy-efficient appliances. Let me just make a few remarks for you and explain the handouts that you're receiving. The bill does, first, we support this legislation. One of the handouts is a letter from the governor indicating that this is one of the priority bills he would like to see on energy pass this session. We also have a short summary of the legislation, a more detailed summary, and then an appendix that actually shows pictures of the appliances that are covered and a description of each of the appliances that would be covered under the bill. The states are, in general, are preempted from setting appliance standards when the federal government has set appliance efficiency standards. Where the federal government has not acted, the states are free to do so. In this case, this bill covers 12 appliances where the federal government has not acted. And the standards would be the same as those that California adopted after an extensive rulemaking that I think extended over 2 years. So that manufacturers would have just one set of standards, wouldn't be different in Oregon from California or from other states. Three other states, New Jersey, Maryland, and Connecticut, have adopted these standards, and they're pending, legislation's pending in 8 additional states as well. Again, the intent is to adopt the identical standards as in California. There are substantial energy and water savings from these measures. We believe that these standards are achievable, and the energy and water savings information is included in your handouts. The payback period for these measures is all very short, as Representative Dingfelder mentioned. All of them less than 4 years. In the case of washing machines, the payback is less than 2 years. For example, in the case of digital television adapters, it's less than 1.5 years. So we think this is good legislation and urge your support. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mike.
There was a question about where appliances are manufactured. Charlie, can you address that?
Mm-hmm. I'm Charlie Stevens. For the record, I apologize in advance for my lack of voice. Most of these products are manufactured in the United States. There are a few outside, typically in Mexico, but most of them are manufactured in the middle of the country, Wisconsin, Arkansas, places like that. And there's Maytag is a big manufacturer. Alliance is a big manufacturer. There's fewer manufacturers of these products than there are for the residential machines. So there aren't that many places to look.
Okay, thank you. I guess we'll go to you then next, Jeff.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Bissonette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. CUB is the representative of residential ratepayers of regulated utilities in the state of Oregon. We are also appearing today in support of House Bill 3363. You've heard already the reasons why this is a good bill and should pass. I'll just also add on to that two items. One is that this does help consumers in terms of bringing down their electric bills, their energy bills, their natural gas bills, their water bills. And so the more energy efficient standards that we have out there and the more we have manufacturers producing products that meet that, the better off consumers are. And then also the other thing I wanted to mention is that you know, we have the state directly to our south with these standards. Good or bad, the state of California is, as Representative Dingfelder said, one of the economies that drives kind of the global market. And so we can sort of piggyback on that and get a pretty huge benefit. At the same time, we can also ignore that, and we can also ignore our neighbors to the north who are trying to adopt similar standards and kind of put ourselves in a place where some energy professionals have noted to me that, you know, we can really become a dumping ground for appliances. And, you know, frankly, we don't want Oregon consumers exposed to that. And so this is a pretty straightforward bill, with little cost to, with almost zero cost to the state, and as has been noted by both Representative Dingfelder and Mr. Graney, very quick paybacks to consumers. And so we heartily support the bill and look forward to answering questions and giving the committee a fairly deep understanding of this. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Questions? Anyone? Don't see any. Thank you very much for your testimony. Could I have Douglas Johnson and Julie Brandis and Mike Dewey?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Craven from the American Electronics Association. I'm just here today to welcome Doug Johnson from the Consumer Electronics Association. He's come out from Washington, D.C. to share some concerns he has with this bill, and we share some common membership in our association. So I'm going to turn it over to Doug. I just wanted to introduce him and welcome him here on this beautiful day to Oregon.
Thanks, Jim. Once again, Doug Johnson, Senior Director of Technology Policy for the Consumer Electronics Association. Like Jim's organization, we're a high-tech trade association, essentially representing all the companies and products you see in your local consumer electronics store. We're based in Washington, D.C., and we're here to talk about the digital television adapter provision of this bill. We have two major concerns, one being that product-specific provision, the other being the blanket license, if you will, to the Department of Energy to create standards for just about any consumer electronics product going forward. We believe the provisions essentially would harm innovation in our industry, in the technology industry. These are not all commercial products in this list. The digital television adapter provision is a consumer product, and it is not commercially available. For the record, it is something that is going to solve a problem. It's something that's going to help people who want to keep their current TVs going forward into the digital transition age maintain reception. Essentially, it's a bridge product for consumers who want to receive DTV. There are products out there that are receivers, but they're not doing what this DTA adapter provision describes. That is transmitting the digital signal into NTSC format. The artificial cap on technology would create more problems. In fact, arguably use more energy. When you cap the energy of a consumer electronics product, you essentially force an out-migration of features and functions into other products. There's a natural tendency toward efficiency in our industry for two reasons. One is physical. When you build an electronics product, it's better to reduce the energy consumption of that product because energy creates heat, and heat is the enemy of long life in products. Secondly, technology products help to save energy. You've seen convergence, I'm sure, from your visits to the local store in our industry. One product essentially replaces two or three nowadays. If all of a sudden you place an artificial cap on what a product can do, you essentially force an out-migration of these products and features into other devices, which could raise the overall energy consumption. We think it's an unwise move to set an artificial standard like this for digital television adapters. We're in the midst of an FCC and congressionally mandated transition to digital broadcasting. As I mentioned, this product serves an important purpose for those consumers who don't want cable or can't afford cable and receive their TV over the air. This is the device that they'll need going forward. It's something that will be in demand once the analog broadcasts stop and we transition to digital completely. And it's very much, in that case, an important part of the digital television transition. So we don't want artificial constraints in this. It's not to say that we're not about energy efficiency in this industry. Our members participate heavily in the Energy Star program at the national level, which is market-oriented and creates an incentive to save energy in the design of products. What's more, our industry creates standards, industry-led standards that have the buy-in and participation from a number of manufacturers, and we feel that this is a much better environment for coming up with standards like this. The 1-watt and 8-watt doesn't make any sense. We see some reference in materials from the proponents pointing to product on the market in Europe. Well, Europe uses a different television standard, and we're puzzled as to why one would want to favor a particular manufacturer in another market when you're coming up with numbers having to do with television reception in the United States. The other provision I mentioned that's of concern to our members is the one that gives the license to the Department of Energy to create such standards for any product. And that would be a huge problem for us, albeit it wouldn't take effect for a few years, but if it would, it would really threaten all products in our industry. So in closing, the Consumer Electronics Association respectfully urges you to remove these provisions. We are in opposition to the bill for those two reasons, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Doug. Of these 12 appliances on there, then you really take an exception with the digital television adapter. I didn't hear you. Same thing, any remarks regarding the other 11?
No, we represent high-tech companies, and there's only one high-tech product identified there. That's the DTV adapter.
Right. Any questions? Representative Holding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for traveling all this way to come out and talk to us about this. I'm curious, are there other kinds of television adapters that would work? You know, basically that would provide the kinds of savings that this bill is looking for that are available in the marketplace?
There's nothing out there right now that translates the digital signal into only NTSC. But there are companies planning to produce such products. But we're puzzled as to how you could come up with these numbers for energy savings and quantify benefits when there's an absence of the product that's in question here. Yes, companies will sell these products going forward. And to the extent that energy efficiency is a concern or should be a concern in the design of the products, we would rather point to the industry standard setting effort. We're an association that sets standards on a number of different fronts, and it's a much better environment to achieve savings, to incorporate energy efficiency as you're thinking about how to design a product. That's the best time to do it. An artificial constraint like this doesn't serve manufacturers' interest or consumers.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I don't see any more. Representative Shields.
Yeah, this question is for Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson, isn't the FCC proceeding really driving the development of DTAs?
Consumers are driving the transition to digital television. The extent that sales continue to increase, I think there were 7.4 million units sold last year. Consumers are driving the transition ultimately. But it's important to note the federal interest in this manifested through Congress and the Federal Communications Commission. So it's quite an important national event, but it's being driven by consumers.
And so, is it important to those consumers that these products be energy efficient?
Our surveys, and we survey consumers on a number of different issues, but the number one and number two reason people buy products in Best Buy or Circuit City are price and features, by far. Energy is on the list and is recognized by about two-thirds of consumers. You know, it's the label's visible on a number of different products nowadays and a number of different products in our industry. But is it the primary reason why people buy it? No. The surveys don't support that. Is it an important reason for some? Yes. And there is a choice out there.
Any other questions? Doug, I too want to thank you for coming all the way from Virginia out here. Tourist industry is very important to us. We'll go to any extreme to get people to come.
I've spent a few dollars already. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, I am Julie Brandis. I'm here today representing Associated Oregon Industries and its Retail Council. AOI is not opposed to conservation efforts. I think our members have done a great deal in the last years to improve conservation in the state. However, I ask you to read the letter of this law and ask yourself, is this really the best use of the Department of Energy, and is this the best way to improve conservation? I have 5 points, and I have tried to list them in order of importance. First, is this the best role for the department? Beginning in January 2010, in Section 7, the legislature will be asking the Department of Energy to complete a variety of tasks related to minimum energy efficiency standards. Honestly, I do not know how much time these tasks will take to complete. But I am really nervous on behalf of my members that 5 years out, we would be putting something on the to-do list for that department. Energy prices continue to concern our members. 5 years from now, we may see the Department of Energy's priorities as far different. In future sessions, I know we, from AOI's point of view, will be asking the Department of Energy to work with other key parties to look for ways to utilize spent pulping liquor, to find ways to site smaller, more efficient generation sites on the west side of the Cascades, to work to implement and coordinate a successful Betsy program. 5 years from now is a very long time in the world of energy. Two, the Department of Energy testing and enforcement. The bill says, and the department may test products specified in this act. The proponents argue that this is not a mandate. However, mere suggestion of this sort in legislation does seem to be a directive by you, albeit a minor one. Okay, so again, is this really what you want the department to be doing? This is a very valuable agency and one that we think does a good job helping Oregon businesses and the economy, especially Oregon's businesses who have been paying extremely high energy rates. Do you really want them policing deli coolers? Three, consider the penalties, Section 11. Now, imagine a business conducting a horrible wrong and installing a cooler that was not up to these standards. Now, suppose it's a small deli, such as the one I worked at when I was going to college, like in Sun River. Now, suppose for whatever reason, the deli has had one warning issued by Mike Graney, who I'm assuming will still be there in 2010, mostly because he has a child at Notre Dame, and, you know, I know how that goes. We've had one offense, and now we have a second offense. And we're going to be charged violations and penalties on a daily basis. So let's say I have a bad deli cooler. How am I going to get rid of it overnight? And how am I going to where am I going to put the food? And in Sun River, it could take days to get a supplier to provide a new cooler. So is this really what you want the Department of Energy doing, is policing businesses, especially small businesses in the state? And are you sure that 5 years from now, this is the best role for the Department of Energy? Point four, one state sets the standard. Go back to Section 7, Sub E. The Department of Energy will update the minimum energy efficiency standards every 4 years. They will update these standards based on any one single state's changes. I understand, and I actually very much agree with the proponents, that they do not want to become a dumping ground for less efficient commercial products. We couldn't agree more. On the other hand, we don't want to set a standard where commercial businesses such as restaurants and grocery stores pay more for a product here than they do in other states, especially if the product isn't available. And especially if the state that's setting the standard and the state of Oregon do not combine to create a substantial or noticeable market share. Point five, ask yourself what this bill does not do. Nowhere in this bill does the legislation encourage the Department of Energy to work with its business community over the next 5 years to voluntarily transition products within our stores, encouraging or incenting businesses to replace inefficient equipment with energy-efficient equipment. When you drive home tonight, think of the great value of the Energy Trust of Oregon. I can just see them putting together a program to help grocers, restaurants, delis to make voluntary conservation changes. There's no need for laws, penalties, enforcement. Just the parties working hand in hand to address conservation issues. This concludes my testimony, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? No? Don't see any. Mike, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. Doug, when you come back out to Oregon again, I've got an idea on some, where to go for tires, so I just want you to think about that. I'm going to be very brief, and I think you'll appreciate that. It's my understanding from the key sponsor of the bill that the digital TV adapters are not going to be included. There's some people that are going to get together and look at this bill, and the recommendation is to take that out. So with that, if that occurs, I'm not going to be involved in this bill. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Offer.
Would it be okay if Mr. Graney came up and addressed some of these points? Is that okay with you?
Certainly.
Okay.
Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it.
Oh, well, and the good representative, I guess. I don't want to leave her out.
Representative Dingfelder, would you like to participate?
I will defer to the Department of Municipal Accessibility.
Okay, all right. Okay. Your questions?
Just some of the points of opposition about the safety and the dumping and it's already going that way. I hope you were listening to some of
that. Mr. Chairman, Representative Schaffler, I think in part it's a question of, one, how quickly we move. Clearly California has adopted these standards, and they take effect, most of them either January 1st of next year or in some cases the following year. And I think with if the state of Oregon doesn't act, there is a legitimate concern that less energy efficient appliances that can't be sold in California will come here in greater quantities. You know, I have to say I appreciate the testimony of AOI. I don't very often get compliments like that. And we certainly are and will be working with businesses with our existing incentives to help them become more energy efficient and continue to do that. In terms of the rulemaking concern, I guess, one, you could put bounds on what our discretion is. Another option is to drop that provision. I mean, I think the idea of subsequent rulemakings is less important than adopting the standards that California has in place. I'm just speaking for myself, not for the bill sponsors, but that would be the department's perspective. Charlie, do you want to add anything on any of the other issues?
Yeah, I could add a few things. Charlie Stevens. The energy use conundrum that most people seem concerned about is something I've studied for quite a long time now, and I've been involved in the standards arena both at the federal level and at the state level for some 15 years now. In fact, I have a personal working relationship with the engineers and the government affairs representatives of most of the manufacturers of a good fraction of the products you see in front of you here today. And I talk to them on a periodic basis, if not a frequent basis, about what they do, why they do it, and where they're going with the products so that I can tailor our programs to those directions. When it comes to digital TV adapters, the most important effect is to connect that to the power supplies, which you see also in this bill. This is called standby power consumption. This is the biggest factor we're after with this standard. Most people don't know about asking about the energy efficiency of these products because there is no label for them. There is no standard for them. People, quite frankly, are clueless about how much energy this thing they're buying actually uses. And in some cases, they use quite a bit. In fact, we have some data from a house in California that used 737 kilowatt hours a year before anybody moved in. And this is all from standby power consumption and consumer electronics products primarily. So there's an enormous amount of power consumption going on. Consumer electronics as a group are about the fourth largest energy consumer in a household today. And a lot of these products are getting bigger and more fully featured, and they're using more and more energy. This is kind of a one-time shot in this case where we're going to need these things very quickly, and we're going to have to all pony up. About a fifth of us may have to pony up and buy one of these things if we want to keep using our analog television. You can make a product like this that does more than that. And in fact, there are some products on the market now, two by LG Electronics and two by Sylvania, that do more than just convert the signal. They do some recording. There's some options there. That's technically not what we're after here. We're after the digital conversion of the signal. That involves the standby power consumption, which is the power supply, which the manufacturers during the testimony in California confirmed would cost about a dollar or less and would pay back in months. The other is just the efficiency of signal processing, quite frankly, and all the biggest manufacturer who was queried in California and who's behind a lot of the research that was done in this admitted that it would be pretty easy to do and it wouldn't cost very much. The product only costs about $30 in its basic form today anyway, and you're adding about a buck to it in large quantity manufacture. Very few of these products, of course, will be manufactured here, but they're all going to come here. The other thing is there's several products on here that are commercial products. They include the coolers. By the way, we won't be going after deli owners. The retailers in question are the retailers of the product, not the users of the product. So we won't be harassing poor deli owners. But the other thing is that in a lot of commercial realms, the person who gets to pay the energy bill for these things doesn't get to pick the equipment. And the person who gets to pick the equipment, not paying the energy bill, doesn't have a lot of incentive to buy the most efficient one out there. They don't care. They're not paying the bill. So that's where standards really, quite frankly, make a lot of sense. And I also have to say, I've been involved at the federal level for a number of years. Standard making at the federal level has virtually ceased. All of the standards that were in process have been set aside for indefinite periods of time, even when they were almost ready to issue. And almost no rulemakings have been surfaced for continuing on. And quite frankly, I think most of the states that are doing this in the federal vacuum. I also suspect that finally when the feds do get around to doing these standards, perhaps our standards will be the ones they adopt. And the more likely that will be, it'll be more likely if we actually have some standards out there to refer to. And they're successful.
Thank you.
Did I miss anything?
I think you're pretty comprehensive there.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you again for your testimony. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on House Bill 3363?
I'm sorry about this.
We need your name for the record.
My name is Mike Marsden.
Afternoon.
Good afternoon. May I read this?
How long is it?
A couple minutes. My name is Mike Marsden. I am president of Coin Meter Companies. Coin Meter rents from apartment owners the common laundry rooms where we install coin-operated washers and dryers specifically for the multiple user. This is the commercial washing machine that we're talking about today. We currently own and operate 6,500 washers and common laundry rooms throughout the state in Southwest Washington. This is about a 25% market share. I also sell the machines to apartment owners who want to operate the laundry rooms themselves. Self-ownership is about 50% of the common laundry room market. While my business is the coin laundry, my industry is the multi-housing market, which consists of apartment residents and its owners. We also provide coin laundry for college housing. House Bill 3363 directly affects the multi-housing industry with its restrictions on the multiple user washing machine. I have three specific reasons why the coverage of the commercial washer should be deleted from this bill. They are the following. The common laundry room market is already moving naturally to Energy Star rated washers. The last few years, we are buying primarily front-load washers and top-load Energy Star models. Both of these machines have met the requirements that are in this House bill. When my father first started this business in 1972, the Speed Queen, which is owned by Alliance, made out of Ripon, Wisconsin, for better or for worse, home of the Republican Party, the top-load washers used about 40 gallons of water. During the energy crunch of the 70s, apartment owners demanded a machine that uses less water. Thus, in the early 80s, Speed Queen made the current version that uses 33 gallons of water, which is about 85% of what we use today. For the past 2 years, due to, again, apartment owners' demands, we have been installing the Latergy Energy Efficient Star rated washers. Currently, we have over 600 of these machines out on the market. In due time, we will replace the older models the majority of our machines will probably use around 26 gallons of water or less. However, some of these machines are more expensive, with the front load costing almost $500 more than the standard top load. The cost difference is hard to justify at the smaller apartment location where revenue per machine is low. Currently, I have 450 locations where I have just one washer and one dryer. I also rebuild and place them back in the market at locations where, again, the revenue per machine is low. Buying these low-priced machines and using rebuilt washers helps me keep my costs down and thus keeping me from charging. I can keep my prices low. We charge a buck to wash and a buck to dry. There is an economic reason why I try to keep my slide prices to a minimum, which I can explain later. In any event, the low-cost washers and not being able to reinstall the older machines back in the marketplace will force me to raise prices. This is without a doubt I will have to raise prices with a mandate for a front-load washer. My second concern is that in the common laundry locations, the new Energy Star washers just won't do a very good job of cleaning clothes. For many of us laundry users, particularly the affluent, who are buying front-load washers for their homes, we don't have very dirty clothes. They are primarily washing clothes, not so much to remove dirt, but to remove body odor. To remove odor from otherwise fairly clean clothes, one doesn't need a whole lot of soap or a whole lot of water to do this. An Energy Star machine like a front loader works just fine for these type of laundry users. This is not the case with many of my residents who live in apartment units that have common laundry rooms, the multiple user. Many of these residents do work at where their clothes get very dirty. They work at our restaurants, they clean our buildings, they do our landscape and much of our maintenance. Some even use cloth diapers instead of plastic ones, and they clean cloth diapers in multiple user machines. This is my biggest concern in regard to multiple users. Does the washer clean the dirty clothes? To clean truly dirty clothes and have a washer that has gotten all the soap and dirt residue out of the machine for the next user, sometimes you just need some more water. My third concern is that the common laundry room is already a huge water-saving resource in the multi-housing laundry industry. This is true even with machines that use 33 gallons of water. When my father first started this business, roughly 95% of all apartments in Oregon had common laundry rooms. When the apartment building boom resumed in the mid-80s after the recession, they started providing each apartment unit with their own washer and dryer. Every resident had their own washer and dryer. This is now an industry standard. Since then, since the mid-80s, almost 90% of every unit that has been built comes equipped with its own unit washer and dryer. There are now many more in-unit washers than there are common laundry room washers. These machines are not restricted in water consumption. This has been going on for 20-plus years. In a 2001, an independent study was done comparing laundry water consumption between in-unit hookups and common laundry rooms. The study shows common laundry rooms that offer coin-operated washers use over 3 times less water than the apartment that has a washer and dryer for each apartment unit. Again, our industry is already a huge water saver. Let's not kid ourselves. Everyone wants to have their own washer and dryer. Many residents are willing to pay more in rent for the chance they have this benefit, so much so that many owners are converting their apartments from common laundry rooms to providing washers in every unit. My biggest competition is no longer the guy willing to rent the laundry room from the apartment owner and offering a better deal, or the owner wishing to own and operate the coin laundry machines rather than use our services. My biggest competition is now the apartment complex next door that has their own in-unit washing machines. This is the main reason why I try everything I possibly can to keep coin slide prices to a minimum, and this mandate will force me to raise them. The more I raise prices, the more the resident, my consumer, looks to see if he or she can find a way to move a place where he or she has his own machines. When that happens, then my customer, the apartment owner, finds a way to close the common laundry room and retrofit each unit with their own washer and dryer. When that happens, then water consumption will really truly surge. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike, for your testimony. Anyone have any questions? Representative Shields.
Just a comment. I just wanted to thank you for coming and bringing this issue forward.
Maytag's made in Newton. Their domestic washer is going to be made in South Korea. That's their front load washer. Alliance, again, is in Ripon. Whirlpool's out of Detroit, Michigan. GE is out of Louisville. Whirlpool, Maytag, and Speedqueen are the primary coin-operated washing machines on the market in the States. There's plenty of other ones in Europe and in Mexico who are in this market.
Thank you, Mike. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3363? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3363. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2958. Janet, can you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, this is Representative Esquivel's bill he sponsored. The measure specifies that a lender in a real estate loan transaction has the burden of documenting to the escrow agent at closing that a borrower owes a prepayment penalty for paying off the loan upon selling the home.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Janet. Representative Esquivel.
Mr. Chair and fellow committee members, my name's Sal Esquivel. I'm representative out of House District 6, which is Medford, Oregon, for the record. The background of this bill actually happened to me. I was in a closing, and the lender, first of all, let me give you some background on loans. Every one of us own a house, has a loan on that house usually, unless you own it free and clear. Well, that is the first lender of your home that is in a first position. They have the first position because they have an economic interest in your home because they've lent you the money. I was doing a refinancing, and a lender called out for a prepayment penalty in the closing. I had no prior notification of a prepayment penalty. I had no prepayment penalty. I objected to the prepayment penalty, and the lender's response was that I had to prove that I did not have a prepayment penalty. They would not prove that I did. That's why this bill's here today. I think about this as you go into a closing and you're closing a transaction. Maybe you're selling your house. And if you don't close that house on that particular day, you may breach your contract. There's some ramifications there and some liability. If a lender arbitrarily puts in a prepayment penalty that you do not owe, then what is your chances at that point of objecting and getting it all straightened out if you're up against a contract? I was lucky. I was doing a refi, so I didn't have that. I did go out and get my records and found out I did not have a prepayment penalty. This was just arbitrarily put on a closing statement. No basis. It was just put there. $3,700, I believe it was. Well, I look at this that I had records. The way some people do records, a lot of people don't have those. Or they can't find them. Or they're up against a contract. A lot of people will look at their closing statement, they'll look if there's a prepayment penalty, and they'll think, well, I must have had one, and go ahead and sign. Or they won't even look at it, their closing statement, and pick up that there is a prepayment penalty in there. So the solution is what you have in front of you today. The solution is to make it mandatory to any lender that calls out for a prepayment penalty, and this is all consumer protection only, that they must provide the documentation to show you there is indeed a prepayment penalty. You're going to hear many facets of this from other people. Too much work. After all, you have to dig up the records to see whether you have a prepayment penalty. My thinking is, if you can call out for a prepayment penalty, then you should be able to have that in your records and provide it. It's not that difficult to fax a copy of your prepayment penalty. You're also going to hear that probably that everyone is required in the state of Oregon to be notified of a prepayment penalty up front. That's true. But you know something? If you didn't have one up front and they call for it in your closing, that doesn't even matter. The next thing you're going to hear is probably it doesn't apply. I don't believe that. No one's proven that to me at all. In fact, LC hasn't been able to get me an answer. You're going to hear that the banks have their own, quote, rules. Well, you know, if you want to do business in the state of Oregon, you do apply to the rules. Example on the prepayment penalty that it calls out for at the beginning of this, that when you sign on one, actually, that's an Oregon state statute. And guess what? They are adhering to it. So I find that invalid. You're also going to hear it just pertains to Oregon banks. This I do not believe, nor will I ever believe that. We have a right to protect consumers in this state. When you have lenders that purposely try to take advantage of people in the tune of $3,000 to $4,000, maybe even $5,000 in each transaction, then we have a problem, and all you need is one of those. And I am an example of one. But if I didn't have my records, I'd end up paying a prepayment penalty. Now, unfortunately here, not all banks, or fortunately, all banks, most of them, are very good. They're credible. But it only takes one. How many closings do you have, refinancing and closings of transactions, do you have in the United States in a day? I wonder how many of them have prepayment penalties that, one, the consumer's not aware of, or two, the consumer doesn't have, and three, the consumer pays. That's the real question here. Are we here to protect the people? Or are we here to make the bank prove that they have a legitimate claim? I think we're here to make the bank prove it has a legitimate claim. And this isn't only just banks. This is private lenders, any lender, anyone that does any real estate transactions. So as you see this bill, it's pretty simplistic. I think you can read it in about a half minute. It's pretty much straightforward to the point. And I'm open for any questions.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Representative Shaw.
Be brief. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this forward. Not only do we have a right to protect the consumer, but we have an obligation, I think. And I just wanted to comment, too. I got piles. Fortunately, I'm married to somebody who has files. So I'm protected there, but I do appreciate it. And I'm glad you're going to stay here and grill those people that come up here and don't think that this is such a great idea with all these wonderful legislators on here. So I look forward to that, too.
Yeah, I think we can probably pass this through the House. I'm not sure.
All right.
Since,
thank you very much.
Let's see. Who's not on this bill? Representative Holby, because he was absent that day. The only reason.
It's the only time he's on.
Any other questions? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Could I have Tim Martinez and Paul Cosgrove, please? Dun, 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 dun.
Mr. Chairman, look at the time. Isn't it time for dinner break? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Tim Martinez, Oregon Bankers Association. I have had several conversations with your vice chair on this issue, and as he indicates, he is not yet convinced that Oregon law does enough in this area, and I certainly respect his opinion. I certainly regret what happened to him in the course of a refinance, but one thing you didn't hear him say in the course of that was that this was not an Oregon lender that was involved. And I think that's very important because, yes, as Mr. Schaffler said, we do need to protect Oregon consumers, but this legislature can only do so much for Oregon consumers. Now, what has this legislature done already in this area? Well, there, as Mr. Esquivel suggested, there is not one but two ORS citations that deal with prepayment penalties. And with the chair's indulgence, I would like to read those to you. The first one is 86-151, and it provides that any person who makes a consumer loan of more than 3 years that is secured by Oregon real property, and I quote, shall with respect to such loan expressly and clearly state on the loan agreement and promissory note any maximum prepayment privilege penalty. The statement shall include the maximum prepayment penalty applicable for prepayment during the first year of the loan period and for each year thereafter. So that's the first one. Second one is 82-161, provides that on any loan for personal, family, or household purposes, whether or not secured by real property, and again I quote, if a loan agreement provides for a penalty to be charged for repaying the loan prior to the date provided for repayment in the loan agreement, the loan agreement shall contain in printing or writing of a size equal to at least 10-point bold or underline type substantially the following notice. And the notice says, do not sign this loan agreement before you read it. This loan agreement provides for the payment of a penalty if you wish to repay the loan prior to the date provided for repayment in the loan agreement. So Oregon not only has one, but two. I understand Representative Esquivel's position is, well, that's great. You get those when you get the loan, but what about when you're getting out of the loan? Well, I would suggest a couple things. First of all, I think most surveys show that a home is probably the largest purchase most of us are going to make in our life. And as such, I think it's incumbent on us to keep that stack of paper that I'm sure each and every one of you read when you bought your home. I mean, it's growing this high now with more and more regulation. But as far as the note and others, and it's critical that you keep that because when you sell the house down the loan, you're going to need to know where your basis is, where you started out as you figure out what kind of gain you have on the house. So I would throw that out for the committee's consideration. As far as the comment about who you're bringing in under this law, I mean, it's we certainly believe, and I know, again, Representative Esquivel still has some questions. He's talked to legislative counsel. I actually got a call from legislative counsel in trying to get some more information to Representative Esquivel's request. And the point I'm trying to raise, we all see these ads on TV for DITEC and for others. It's certainly our belief and our council's belief, who I didn't bring here today for you. I just thought that Paul and I would take this one without having Mr. Sherman go on for a long period of time. But it's certainly our belief that in those loan documents, they're going to tell you which state's laws this loan is going to be made under. And more often than not, those out-of-state lenders are going to use their current law, not Oregon law. It's the same thing with credit card companies. A few years ago, back when we had a credit card bank in Oregon, this legislature passed a bill changing late fees that really had a minimal impact on Oregon consumers because they didn't have that many customers here, but was killing them in the marketplace, the national marketplace, because they couldn't be competitive with the credit card companies that were located in the Dakotas and New Jersey and other places that had more favorable late fees for the lender's perspective. So I think it's fairly clear, at least in our mind, that you would certainly roll into this legislation all Oregon lenders. And again, they already have those two protections in Oregon statute now. But you would not roll in those that choose to use the law of the state where they're organized or where they're, in their sense, making the loans. So I would stop at that point and would also, just for the committee's information, tell you that Paul and I are also here on behalf of the United Financial Lobby, which includes the Oregon Bankers Association, the Credit Union Association, the mortgage bankers, the mortgage brokers, the consumer finance folks, and we are all in opposition to this bill.
Thank you, Jim. Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Financial Services Association. We make a number of mortgage loans in the state through state regulation under the Department of Consumer and Business Services and have a number of members with offices all over the state. Our concern echoes Mr. Martinez's, but we have one additional one. The bill as written talks about the burden of providing to the escrow agent at the closing. Most of our members' loans are not closed in escrow. Now, that's obviously a solvable problem, but I think most people assume that mortgage loans are always closed in escrow. In fact, we don't. We close them in our offices and then submit documents to a title company. There is no escrow company, so it's just an additional issue reflecting that we make our loans differently than the traditional bank does. We make them in our offices. So that would be a problem for us because we wouldn't have any place to prove it to. So a concern. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yeah, boy. For Mr. Martinez, you did ask me about that, and I did say it was an out-of-state lender that provided the prepayment penalty, but the original loan was from an Oregon lender. So when that's sold on a secondary market, if my memory serves me correct, it has to go by the letter of the lender. That was not done.
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Escal, that's absolutely correct.
So it was an Oregon lender that originated the loan, and it was Oregon money from Portland.
And Mr. Chair Brown, Representative Escobar, that's what I've understood you've told me, but I also believe that when you looked at your original documentation, you were able to verify that there was no prepayment penalty in those original documents.
I don't dispute that.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you.
Is there anyone else to testify on House Bill 2958? Seeing none, I close the public hearing.
Mr. Chair, I'm really watching my language isn't here today because my little princess Marcella isn't back there. So I ask you all to watch your language too.
That will be a test. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3256. And Janet, again, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3256 is at the request of the Associated Oregon Industries and would clarify that the state whistleblower protections apply to employees who take certain actions against their own employer and not against any employer. The amendments are fairly simple. The change on line 7 is just a wording change that Legislative Council did, but the change on line 11 changes the an employer to the employer. As you may know, the Oregon whistleblower statutes protect employees from discharge, demotion, or other retaliation for taking certain actions in good faith against their employer. The Associated Oregon Industries is a bit concerned that this could apply to any company and not just the employer's company. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Lisa Trussell, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with AOI, and I want to thank you for...
Just a minute, Lisa. I understand this is your birthday?
Oh, gosh. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's my happy 49th and holding.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. I'm all frustrated. House Bill 3256, and the Administrator Adkins just went over with you, is a pretty simple change, although I see my friends from Bully are still in the room, so they may not think it's as simple as I do.
There's one more bill.
It's always a pleasure. But the situation has arisen where I think that, and they'll have the history on it, but for a lot of people, the understanding is that the whistleblower protection applied to you if you were suing your own employer. And with the way the statute's worded, as it's indicated, an employer, so that pretty much involves if you have a litigation going with anybody who's got an employee, you're suing an employer. And so what our thought was to make a real simple change. As it was indicated on line 7, that is not our recommendation. That was legislative counsel's. But all we were asking for is what's on line 11, where instead of saying an employer, it says the employer, implying the worker's employer. And unfortunately, I was not able to get any of my members who are interested in the issue into Salem tonight, but they are seeing their concern. Originally, there was a concern that basically any time you had litigation going and something adverse happened to your place of employment, whether it was related or not, you could allege the whistleblower protection. And now they've got stronger concerns to this point in that there's been apparently some federal court decisions or something along those lines that have been interpreted along the lines that it doesn't have to be your own employer suing. So we would just ask for what we think is clarification and make it clear that it's your own employer. And we would ask that you could support this very simple change to the statute.
Thank you, Lisa. Any questions? I don't see any. Thank you.
Thanks.
Annette Talbot, please.
Happy birthday, Lisa. Mr. Chair, Annette Talbot, Deputy Labor Commissioner for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Katie's passing around my testimony for you. And I would say that this is a case where one word matters greatly. And
I was going to say, you've got two pages out of
I know. she was accusing me of lawyering up, so I apologize. But I'm a recovering attorney. So this is a case where we have two separate types of whistleblowing statutes. The one before you in 230 is what we often refer to as the criminal whistleblowing statute. It actually also would involve someone who's engaged in a report that led to a civil proceeding. But this applies to all employees, not just public sector employees like the other whistleblowing statute. So it is entirely possible that you would report some criminal activity about an individual who's not your existing employer, but that your employer might not be inclined to support your whistleblowing and therefore take some action against you. So it is not necessarily the employer for whom you're employed that you would be whistleblowing about. So you could have an experience doing whistleblowing and have that follow you if you change jobs to another employer you weren't even employed with at the time, but that employer decides to, when they find out about your whistleblowing activity, discriminate against you, particularly if you had maybe taken on some kind of whistleblowing activity that might make their industry look bad or had some with a friend of the company, and they found out after they hired you that you had whistleblown on someone else. So our testimony points out that clearly this is a policy issue for the legislature, but we believe that there is a reason why the statute is as it's written now, and that the change would put a chilling effect on whistleblowing, which I think this legislature has supported greatly throughout the years, and finds that whistleblowing can provide a great benefit both in the public and the private sector. So we would ask you to take that into consideration, and also note that in every other similar type of whistleblowing statute in the Oregon law relating to OSHA, workers' comp, civil rights, that and unemployment benefits, that it extends beyond the current employer for whom you now work, so that they give you protections that are broader than the current employer. So we have a few limited cases where we've actually had a final order on whistleblowing, and sometimes they have involved an employer, an individual who has reported someone other than their employer, but then their employer, due to that report, has taken action against them due to that whistleblowing. So we do believe that the better public policy is to leave it as broad as it is, as much as it pains me to disagree with Ms. Trussell on her birthday. So I hope I'd be glad to answer any questions, Mr. Chair, members, if you have any.
And so, and that your concern is the changing the "and" to "the." But what about "because" up there, for the reason?
Mr. Chair, that's just one of those legislative council things that they believe would improve the statute. So, as far as I know, as Ms. Trussell testified, I don't know that that change in and of itself is substantive. It's that line 11, deleting the "and" and putting in "the," that causes us some trouble policy-wise.
Wouldn't if you're telling the authorities, whoever that may be, that there's some problem with someone else's employer, that would be, I mean, just doing your civic duty if there's a criminal activity there. So wouldn't I, you know, I wouldn't even characterize it as whistleblowing. But if you know that there's criminal activity going on, you have some obligation to report it, I would think.
Mr. Chair, I believe that's exactly why the statute was passed, was that the legislature believed that people should be able to take that kind of responsibility, report those kinds of activities, be it criminal or some kind of other serious civil proceeding, or talking to a law enforcement agency, and not get in trouble with their employer for doing so.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Annette, some of the biggest scandals that we've had, the SNL scandal, Enron, other corporate scandals that we've had in the last couple of years have been because, in my understanding, because the Big Eight accounting firms or the Big Five in later years or however many there were giving clean bills of health to insolvent companies, insolvent SNLs. How do you think this change might affect that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, I think that those instances show you that whistleblowers often do experience a lot of retaliation. And depending on where that whistleblower lived, if they lived next door and worked for a different employer, but they blew the whistle on a next-door employer that, or an accounting firm that another employer they wanted to go work for used, and that employer could discriminate against them, I think they would find themselves in a lot of hot water, because this change would, even though it's only that one word, would indicate that the policy would only apply to the employer to whom they work at the time. And especially in industries that are very close-knit, where you have sort of everybody knows everybody, so if you aren't able to, you know, ever whistleblow in that instance, you wouldn't get people doing it very often, I don't think, if they're not protected. I'd be glad to work with Ms. Trussell on whatever case that her folks have indicated might be troubling to them. I'm not aware of a case that deals with this Oregon statute, but so I will circle back around with her, and we get our lawyers to talk to each other to see what issues are out there. And I would commit to the committee to do that to see if there's a bigger issue out there that we're not aware of.
Aren't the lawyers a problem in the first place?
Well, Mr. Chair, as a recovering attorney, I probably shouldn't comment.
God bless you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Annette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone else to testify on House Bill 3256? And then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3256. And next is House Bill 3319. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we go from a simple bill to a not-so-simple bill with a not-so-simple amendment. There are -1 amendments to House Bill 3319. This is the other bill at the request of the Associated Oregon Industries. Mr. Chair, the -1 amendments also involve Mr. Cosgrove, so he may want to explain part of those amendments. Mr. Chair, current law requires employers to make up the wages plus pay penalty wages if the employer pays less than the full wages required, and there's also a penalty if the employer does not pay wages when an employment ceases, if the employee employer does not pay wages according to the time periods in Oregon statute. Employers are concerned that the penalties may be claimed under both statutes, and that's the subject of the bill. And I think I'm going to have the proponents explain it. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa and Paul.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm still Lisa Trussell. It's still my birthday, and I'm still representing AOI. And I'm handing out testimony, but as the committee administrator indicated, this bill's a little bit more detailed. The concept that we thought was relatively easy until we got into the explanation, as sometimes is the case. What we're trying to do, and we've had discussions with Boley in the past on concerns with the potential for double penalties for the same set of situations or facts, circumstances. And this typically happens when there's been a mistake on a paycheck, and that paycheck happens to be the final paycheck. So in a situation like that, the employer is given a penalty under the various statutes for the incorrect payment, and then there's the potential for an additional penalty because that violation happened to incur on the final paycheck. And there's, and I meant to bring with me tonight, and I forgot, Boley's put together a really good couple of charts on the different penalties, both civil and criminal, that they have the ability to assess throughout their statutes. But this bill amends, and I want to make sure I don't have a typo on there, 653.055 in the original bill is printed. And that's the statute that applies penalties for wage and wage violations under ORS 653.010 to 653.261. And we tried to amend that bill so that it would indicate that with respect to the penalty that's available under 652.150, which deals with the termination issues, that it would only apply if the employer willfully failed to pay the wages of the employee when their employment stopped. As to the Dash 1 amendments, which we support and believe are necessary to accomplish our goals, the pertinent part for AOI is begins on page 3, and it's line 15 with sub B. And it was our recommendation to also put language into 652.150, the statute that deals with the terminations, a clarification that the employer would only get one penalty for this, rather than multiple penalties for violating two different statutes with the same set of facts. And we're not saying that every untimely payment of wages or failure to pay overtime on a terminated employee has led to multiple penalties. But it's our understanding that some courts have applied them, and there's nothing in our current statute to prevent that. And it's also our understanding that wage complaints don't have to be filed at Boley. They can go straight to the courts. And the Bureau of Labor and Industries assured us that they're not applying multiple penalties, but they're not the only ones that are enforcing this law. So we would respectfully ask that you give House Bill 3319 with a Dash 1 amendment your positive consideration and move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and anticipating that there might be some people who are concerned about our proposal, we'd be happy to work with them on this bill as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Cosgrove representing Addis Healthcare. And if I can, I just need to talk a little bit about what Addis does and how they employ people in order to explain the rest of the Dash 1 amendments, which AOI has been kind enough to allow us to insert into 3319 or support if we insert into 3319. Addis Healthcare is a home care agency. They employ a number of people who go into the homes of seniors and disabled people and provide either housekeeping services services or personal care, grooming, and help with eating and other daily functions. Most, if not all, of those services are provided under contract to area agencies on aging through Oregon Project Independence funding that you provide as a legislature, or directly under contract with the Department of Human Services for people on the Oregon Health Plan. There may be a few private pay patients, but in fact almost all of them are through one of those two programs. When Addis is asked to provide those services, a caseworker at either DHS or one of the AAA agencies authorizes X number of hours of X number of services for a particular client. And we find one of our employees who's got the time and the skill set, and they're sent to the client's home to provide those services. Sometimes it is as little as 1 hour a day for a period of 2 weeks, for example. That might be quite a common situation. When the person is finished, our employees finished providing those services, we then call them up and see if they're ready for a new assignment. And many of our employees, in fact, most of them work part-time. It may be a number of days before we actually get in touch with our employee, and of course we don't know what they're doing in the meantime. And in fact, because these are relatively low-paid jobs, sometimes they have found full-time employment with someone else. And so the reason they're not calling us back is, in fact, they're employed elsewhere. So they are in the situation where they have voluntarily quit their job. Under current Oregon law, there are two different ways for an employer to handle someone who's voluntarily quit. We're not talking about somebody who's fired. We're talking about somebody who voluntarily quits. If the employee gives you notice of at least 48 hours beforehand, I should check to make sure I'm saying that correctly. If they give you notice, there's one time within which you must give them their paycheck. That's set out, if you look at the bill, on page one of the dash and one amendments, excuse me, in lines 9 through 14. That's for somebody who has given you notice that they're going to quit, and that's the deadline within which you must give them their final paycheck. Under current Oregon law, if you look at the stuff that isn't bold on lines 15 through 20 of page one of the dash one amendments, there's a different timeline if they don't give you notice. Logically, current Oregon law provides if you've got notice the person's going to quit, you can give them their final paycheck quicker. If you don't have notice they're going to quit, you get some extra time to do the final paycheck. In our particular case, we may not know for quite a while after they have actually quit. We may not know that. And in fact, one of the other particular circumstances that we have is that we're paid, reimbursed by those two agencies based on the timesheets. We need to have the timesheets back from the person in order to get reimbursed from DHS and AAA, because that timesheet is not only a record of what the employee worked, it's also a signature by the person who's gotten the services, the senior or the disabled person, that the services were delivered. And we need to have that signed timesheet. So we cannot pay until we get the signed timesheet. The dash one amendments in section one, which is page one of the amendments, through page two, address the issue that if you are an employer who regularly requires their employees to turn in timesheets as a condition of being paid, like we have to, that you have 5 days after the time period that they turn in those timesheets to be able to pay them on their final paycheck. Again, this is again when they haven't given you notice, they have to give you your timesheet that's signed by the client, and then we pay them within 5 days. That's what Section 1 of the Dash 1 amendments does. Section 2, the lines for the first half of the page deal with a slightly different but related issue, and that is if somehow you miss those deadlines and you're dealing with a part-time employee, current Oregon law requires that the penalty, even if you paid all the wages they are due and owing for the work they actually did, but if they only worked a couple hours a day, the penalty is based on 8 hours a day. So you can, in fact, get a penalty wage if you miss that deadline that might be significantly greater than the actual wages they were due, and those penalties can go up very quickly. Section 2, the first part of Section 2, provides that the penalty, if you've missed the deadline, should be based on the average number of hours the person worked. You owe them the wages for that, plus you owe them a penalty equal to the wages for that, but you don't necessarily owe them 8 hours of wages for each day you've missed the deadline, unless they actually were an 8-hour-a-day employee. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I think the in my conversations with Boley about our portion of the amendments, there's been some sympathy with respect to the concept. I think we may need to do some additional work. I think they'd like us to narrow this a bit, but at least that's the concern we're trying to fix and the reasons we're trying to fix it. And as I said, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Paul. Is there any questions? Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. You know, it will come to no surprise to you if I'm pretty sensitive to people getting paid for working. I know you touched on this, but is this all over the place? And why don't we just take, and I can, you have a very good logical argument, why pile on a bunch of penalties? Unless, of course, they're doing it all the time, and then I do something more than just put this penalty on them. Why don't we just put one great big penalty on there and keep everybody honest? No, so they don't keep an honest man honest. That's what I'm trying to do here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shoffler, I believe that there are cases that have been highly publicized where the Bureau of Labor's come in and found that there was, paychecks weren't being properly issued, and everybody kind of knew it. It was all kind of. But I think what we're talking about here is where it's not a mass thing. It's on an individual basis, and mistakes happen, and for a variety of reasons. But there are it just because your paycheck is short doesn't automatically indicate that your employer was trying to rip you off. There are reasons for it. Sometimes the wrong pay bracket is put on there. Some of them the cards the employee fills out themselves. So it's not. I'm not suggesting that there aren't appropriate penalties that should be applied, but I think that what we're saying is that in these cases where you've got a specific rule was violated, overtime wasn't calculated correctly, as an example. Okay, so there's a penalty, you pay the wage, and then there's a penalty assessed. But all I'm asking is that simply because that overtime assessment happened to fall on the last paycheck, I don't think there should be an additional penalty assessed simply because it was the final paycheck. And that's, and again, I will get for the committee the list, but there's quite an extensive list, and maybe they brought it with them today, of different penalties that the agency has to assess in their toolbox. They would still keep this penalty. It just wouldn't always apply. And as I said in my testimony, I'm not saying that every time one of those situations arises, there is a double penalty, but there have been, and you don't have to go to the Bureau. Somebody can go straight to the courts. So they have that flexibility. So, no, I'm not trying to encourage people to not pay their workers.
I believe you.
Okay. And it's my birthday.
Is there any other questions? I don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all.
I have Steve Lanning and Christy Armand and Joe Schaefer. Christy, when we start?
I guess I've been elected to go first. Good evening, Chair Brown and members of the committee. My name is Christine Hammond, and I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division of the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. We have several concerns regarding House Bill 3319 and the Dash 1 Amendment and urge you to oppose the bill and the amendment as currently written. I feel like we need to set the record straight about the difference between the civil penalty that's currently provided in the law and the penalty wage provisions. House Bill 3319 would repeal civil penalties that are payable to employees if their employer has failed to pay them minimum wage and or overtime. Has nothing to do with the final paycheck. This penalty applies to failure of an employer to pay the minimum wage that's required by law or overtime. There is another separate penalty under the law for employers who willfully fail to timely pay the final wages of employees, and those provisions have nothing to do with the failure to pay minimum wage and or overtime. So we're talking about two distinctly different violations and two different penalty provisions. Sometimes they both may be assessed if an employee terminates their employment and isn't timely paid by their employer And in addition to that failure to be timely paid, there's a minimum wage or overtime violation. The Bureau's policy is not to assess the civil penalty for the minimum wage or overtime violation simply because the final paycheck of the employee was missed. We look to see whether or not there is a practice by the employer of failing to pay minimum wage or overtime before assessing that civil penalty. And again, the civil penalty goes to the employee. So our position is it is not a double penalty, and we have not yet seen a court case where a double penalty was assessed for the same violations. We've seen court cases where penalties have been assessed for the minimum wage and overtime violations, and a separate penalty was assessed for the final pay violation, but not a penalty for the same thing twice. The main thrust of the Dash 1 amendment is to create an exception to the final pay provisions of the current law for employees who are required to submit time cards to their employees. Our experience is that most employers require their employees to submit time cards if the employee is a non-manager or non-exempt position. The way we read this amendment is that if an employee failed to turn in their time cards after terminating their employment, the employer would never have to pay them their final wages. The impetus has been shifted in the amendment from the employer to the employee for documenting the number of hours worked by that employee. And the current law requires employers to maintain a record of hours worked. So we don't think it's appropriate to require the employee to submit their time cards before ever getting paid, and relieving the employer of any obligation to ever pay that employee for not submitting the pay time cards. It is permissible for an employer to require an employee to submit a time card, and many do. But again, we don't think it's appropriate to withhold payment if an employee fails to turn in those final time cards. And we would suggest there are other ways that an employer can determine the hours worked by employees, and we typically investigate disputes about the number of hours worked, and there are other ways to nail those down other than just the time cards, which sometimes, you know, they can get lost. There can be disputes between the employer and the employee. Time cards aren't always the last word on how much is owed to an employee. We do understand that in the case that Mr. Cosgrove was discussing, there might be situations where public funding to reimburse an employee might require some sort of documentation, and we'd be willing to talk to Mr. Cosgrove about maybe a narrow exception for that industry, but the way the amendment is written would apply to virtually any employee who is currently required to submit a time card, and that worries us. We're concerned about the adverse impact that would have on the enforcement resources of the agency, and believe that it would serve to drive up the number of wage claims we received and disputes about the circumstances of an employee's termination. Finally, the Dash 1 amendment proposes to limit the amount of penalty wages owed to an employee who regularly works fewer than an 8-hour day shift. And we would point out that in 1995, the legislature enacted the current language in the law, which requires the penalty wages to be computed based on an 8-hour day, regardless of the number of hours worked by the employee. Prior to 1995, the language required that the penalty wages be computed on the average earnings of the employee. If we were to adopt the language in the Dash 1 amendment, it would require us to go back and reconstruct the average number of hours worked in the last two pay periods for the employee. The pay periods could be as much as 60 days, or the law actually permits pay periods to be as far apart as 35 days. So if you're looking at two pay periods, that could require us to possibly look at the number of hours worked for a 70-day pay period by that employee in order to calculate their penalty wages. Those records aren't always available, and it would be a lot more complicated for both the Bureau of Labor and Industries and any court to determine what that employee's average daily number of hours for the last two pay periods would be. I think those are all my comments. I'm available to answer any questions.
Christy, I heard you right. You said that the employee was not obligated to turn in a time card. You know, I have about 25 people work for me. I wouldn't know how much to pay them or, you know, what if they didn't turn in a time card.
Chair Brown, I understand. The law does allow an employer to require their employees to turn in time cards. It is, however, our position that an employer may not withhold wages from an employee before the time cards are submitted. So what we counsel employers to do, if they have employees that fail to turn in their time cards, they can take disciplinary action up to and including termination, but an employer may not withhold wages for failing to receive time cards from that employee.
How do you know how much to pay them then?
Exactly.
Well, Chair Brown, employers should require their employees to submit time cards, and of course that's what you use as a basis for computing their wages. But if they do not turn in their time card, you can't withhold their wages, and there are other ways to determine what they are due. If you had an employee that repeatedly refused to comply with your directive to turn in time cards, it's our position that disciplinary action would be in order, including terminating that employee.
So I take the disciplinary action, but I still don't know what to pay him. I don't know whether he worked 40 hours or 50 hours or what, unless I have a time card to give it from. I don't understand that at all. Representative Shaw.
If they're working minimum wage, Mr. Chair, you can just give them one good tire. Forgive me, Mr. Chair. He's not going to call on me again if I keep that up. Well, Mike, there's a lot going on here. I see the logic in not penalizing somebody who just made a mistake piling on. I see that. On the other hand, if somebody out is abusing them, I'd like to pile on them. My first question is, do you see how you can help work this out, iron this out, so we can get to the common sense logical conclusion? And the second thing that hasn't been said here, my wife's business, she sends all her money to a payroll service. What if they make a mistake? And just for the record, when I was in the union, I still got them, I kept a logbook, and it's good as gold in a court of law, I've been told. Never had to use it. But I would recommend all employees of anybody, anywhere, to keep track. Those are my questions. Is there hope? And what if you have a payroll service?
Representative Shoffler and Chair Brown, I'm glad you brought up the point about the mistakes. We never assess penalties against an employer for making a simple mistake. We only assess penalties if there is a clear intent or pattern and practice of failing to pay minimum wage and overtime. We're never waiting to pounce on an employer for making an inadvertent mathematical error in computing an employee's wages. That's not what we do.
And the hope part?
The hope part?
Can we get some logic? I see their point. Is there anything we can do to...
Well, Representative Shoffler, again, we disagree with the concept that there are double penalties for the same violation. So I personally don't see a lot of hope there. We are willing, again, as I indicated, to work with Mr. Cosgrove to maybe... provide a process for his industry and where a reimbursement from a public agency is required. But again, the way the current amendment is drafted, it pretty much would apply to any and every employee that fills out a time card and allow the employer to withhold their final paycheck.
And Mr. Chair, please, I also happen to be of the understanding that if you're willing to work and hustle, you can make a good living at Les Schwab Tire Centers. Just wanted to get that on.
Have you got some bills coming up?
What do you want to hear in for,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Christy, I've got a question in regards to Mr. Cosgrove's situation where they're getting reimbursement from an agency for time.
Is it the case where if his company or whatever does not get the reimbursement, that does that in some way forgive him for making payment for wages to the employee?
Chair Brown, Representative Holvey, absolutely not.
That's all I had.
Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, if you do anything, please work on that statement you made about the time cards. That needs to be cleared up about not submitting the time cards but paying the person and not withholding because you don't know what they have for hours. I mean, I'm not even following you on that one. I'm sorry.
Would you like me to respond?
No, I'm just making a statement there. That doesn't even make sense.
Representative Holman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask something about the time cards. Is it the employer's choice whether or not the employee is required to have time cards or give time cards, or could the employer say, well, I'm going to have a supervisor keep track of the time cards to, you know, if you're having trouble having your employees submit time cards? I would think that that's the employer's choice whether or not the employee submits the time cards or whether a supervisor signs off on them or how that's handled.
That's exactly right, Representative Holvey and Chair Brown. Employers are currently required by law. They are responsible for tracking the hours worked by their employees. As I indicate, a lot do require their employees to turn in time cards. But as a manager, I'm responsible for monitoring the work hours of the employees I supervise. And again, there are other ways to determine that when an employee leaves their final work shift and doesn't turn in their time cards. You can talk to their coworkers and reconstruct the number of hours they've worked. It is possible.
Any other questions? Joe, why don't you?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is Joe Schaefer. I'm a political organizer for SEIU Local 503. And I'm here today to talk about a couple of bills. 3319 is the first one. And the first thing I'd like to say is, as I've been with the union for several years now as an internal organizer and recently came to work on the political stuff, and I've fielded hundreds of phone calls about, you know, questions over people's paychecks and whether or not they were, you know, correctly given the right amount of money. And I can tell you that I have never experienced or known of anyone who the first thing that they did when they saw a problem with their paycheck called Boley. The first thing folks do is they go to their employer, they go to somebody and say, hey, this seems a little short to me. All right, so that's how mistakes are cleared up. Right? When it goes to Boley, it's in an instance where somebody is being cheated out of pay, or they believe that and they have a case to bring forward. So for what this bill talks about to me, it's somebody who is being cheated out of pay that they earned. They put in the day's work, they get their day's pay. And the analogy that comes to mind to me is I recently had my house broken into. It was a year and a half ago now. And if the police had caught the guy that took my property and was able to return my property to me, I still think that guy should have been charged with theft, right? You get the property back, and the guy is still a thief, and he gets charged for it. And that's what the same principle should apply here. If an employer tries to cheat or steal their wages of their employees, they should be penalized for that. And that's something that, I mean, we all face it every day. If somebody, you know, commits a crime against you, you expect retribution or justice to be done, and that's what we expect to be done here as well.
We got Steve left here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Lanning. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We are not in support of House Bill 3319 and the -1 amendments. And I'm glad that it came out in the discussion earlier that we're not talking about inadvertent bookkeeping errors. We're talking about something more serious than that. And when it comes to workers' wages and being paid on time and accurately, it's very important, and I think we all understand that. We've heard various discussions over the previous four or five sessions about changing this whole area of the law in one way or another and providing something in writing from the workers and different variations of it. And we just haven't heard any arguments that really make sense. But what we've been doing is paying attention to the way that this law is administered, and it seems like it works to us. And we're not interested in having it changed. We're not convinced that it needs to be. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Don't say any. Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it. Is there anyone else to testify on House Bill 3319?
Chair Brown and members of the committee, I'm Steve Schneider, representing Schneider Equipment, a small water systems contractor. And I didn't come here today to testify on this, but after listening to the last testimony and actually all the testimony, I just felt I had to. It was all I could do to get my chair from stop from standing up. But, first of all, we'd support the bill and especially the amendments. We've experienced situations in dealing with final paychecks that in trying to comply with the law are rather burdensome. We use ADP, automated debt payroll or processing, something like that. It's a payroll service.
Yeah,
okay.
I do too.
Okay.
Yeah.
And to do a final paycheck outside of that service is rather cumbersome. I have my office manager here to testify if you don't believe me. It requires actually cutting a separate check rather than using the automated paychecks. Some of these employees actually have automatic payroll deposits to the bank. We need to be able to, number one, allow the standard lead time that a paycheck comes out for people that are quitting. To have to turn it the same day or within 5 days or any other time is unreasonable. If they're used to a standard paycheck coming every Friday, why, when they quit, can't they expect it to come that following Friday? So that's one point. As far as time cards, we have our people fill out their own timesheets. Same thing. To do otherwise, we do a lot of service work, so we have maybe one person going around fixing a pump or doing his thing. To sit there and expect us to know exactly what time he quit or exactly what time he started, starting may be a little easier, but the quitting time can be rather difficult. It means we almost have to have somebody following him around. Well, you're going to double your costs just to do this, so you make sure you're right and not going to be subjected to bully's penalties. That's rather, I think, absurd. And also, there was the point brought up, I can't remember what it was, by somebody of the last three here, that employees go to the employer first whenever there's a question. I can testify that has not happened in at least one situation I can think of where an employee, ex-employee of ours, went straight to Bully to complain. And they do not come to us to try to make a resolve. We ended up with a $1 million claim against our company as a result thereof that was finally settled for $1,300 and some without any admission of guilt or wrongdoing. And this was over overtime. It's not fair. And Bowley sided with him strongly. Not only that, we've just experienced and come off of some other litigation at the hands of Bowley. Bowley has said that they would never assess for any unintentional overtime or lack of payment. That's not true. They nearly brought us to bankruptcy. They were well on their way. They took us to court in two venues over a prevailing wage issue. And this wasn't over final paychecks, but nevertheless, it shows you how far off this agency can get when they're given the authority to issue civil penalties. We succeeded in defending ourselves in both those venues. Bowley walked away scot-free. The state of Oregon didn't. Obviously, they had to pay a lot of legal fees for the Department of Justice and Bowley staff. It cost us well into six figures to defend ourselves from our innocence. That's not okay. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions?
I do have a question. It's not for Mr. Schneider, actually. It's for Bowley. If I quit this job today, does the state have to cut me a check today?
Turn in your time card, though.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, no, they do not. If you are fired, terminated by the employer, you do have to immediately pay all the pay. If you are one who quits, you can be paid within the normal pay cycle that you used to. And one other thing to remember on final wages is if you look back to the 2001 legislative session, then Representative Winters, now Senator Winters, put through a bill on final wages, which requires that the employee, if the final wages are improper, to in writing to the employer submit a claim. The employer has 10 days to make that right before any civil penalties are included as far as final wages are concerned. And that just plain flat is the simple case of the law before those are ever involved.
That's all I need to hear, sir.
Thank you.
And if I may say something quickly about time cards, Mr. Chair, is that I've never been authorized to work overtime without working with a supervisor. And, you know, when I was a line employee and when I was a supervisor, I'd never allow an employee to work overtime without letting me know. And, the employer does set the schedule and shift of an employee's day. And the other thing to remember is that when an employee takes off for sick time, if they're sick, they need to go home early, they have to notify their employer. When they have a doctor's appointment and want time off, they do notify the employer. The employer should have ways of knowing when the employee wasn't there, because if they are taking off and going to the doctor or taking off and going home sick without telling the employer or the supervisor, you've got more problems than just figuring out what their pay is.
With all due respect, Commissioner, I try very hard to make absolutely sure that all of my employees are paid absolutely everything that they have coming. My problem is not with making sure what they get done, but if they don't tell me, I don't have the time card, I don't have the information there to make sure they've got everything coming that they're entitled to, it's difficult for me to do. And if I'm breaking the labor laws by doing that, well, then I have a problem with the issue.
Well, Mr. Chair, with all due respect, what we do through the wage and hour division as far as overtime and other issues, we don't impose civil penalties. What we try to do is work with the employer to straighten out the situation, whether it be meals and rest period complaint, overtime complaint, or anything else. Unless there is an intentional and willful violation on the part of the employer, we don't assess civil penalties. We try to work with the employer and employee to see that correct pay is set, and if the employer is right, then we side with them. If the employee is right, we side with them. It depends on where the evidence lies when you conduct an investigation. Most employers in the state of Oregon, 99.9%, are exactly as you said, Mr. Chair, trying to make sure that the employee is paid correctly. And I firmly believe that it's the small percentage that we end up dealing with.
Thank you for your testimony. I close the public hearing on 3319 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2476. Hey, Janet, can you give us a rundown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2476 would replace current Oregon overtime pay requirements for work on public contracts with federal Fair Labor Standards Act requirements, and the difference affects overtime of more than 10 hours a day, and work on holidays and weekends. That's the difference between the federal requirement and the state requirement. And again, this is just dealing with public contracts.
Okay. Could I have Steve Schneider, Michael Darby, and Jeff Dorr? Is that Dorr? Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Brown, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Dean. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Associated Builders and Contractors. I apologize for my handwriting. Apparently, it's not so clear, so hopefully we'll clarify that here shortly. I am simply here to introduce to you Steve Schneider, who you just met several minutes ago. ABC is in support of this legislation, and we dropped it on behalf of him at his request. And he will be able to fill you in and on the details of how this affects contractors in Oregon.
Chair Brown and members of the committee, also with me is my office manager, Michelle Darby, not Michael.
I apologize.
That's okay, Mike, right? Okay. I'm here because we've experienced a fair amount of, well, let's just say I've had quite some experiences over the last few years in dealing with overtime and especially daily overtime. And I've done a lot of research since then. We run a small operation. We do about 70% of our work is public works construction. We do about anything to do with water. We've explored daily overtime with BOLI in a variety of venues, some of them in the courtrooms, which isn't always very pleasant, and especially when you're innocent. One of the key issues of daily overtime right now is how it's computed. And BOLI contends they're right and we contend they're wrong. We still comply with what they have told us to do at great cost. The administrative handling of just overall daily weighted overtime, or daily, excuse me, not daily weighted, but just daily overtime is pretty significant. It's also, we have found, it's not compatible with federal overtime rules and laws. Specifically, the Fair Labor Standards Act, and the federal law actually changed in 1986, over 20 years ago, when they repealed the daily overtime requirements. They now, like if it's Davis-Bacon contract or something of that nature, it's strictly 40-hour week, same as our general overtime laws in this state. But the way the methodology works, and especially when you're dealing with multiple pay on job sites, which often happens because in the enforcement of prevailing wage, which is usually applied on public works contract, Lowly asks us to break down to the nearest quarter hour any change in task that an employee might be doing. This ends up with different pay rates during that pay week, and we pay every week. We also do non-prevailing wage work, and so employees may shift from private to public and back and forth. So we could see a half a dozen pay rates in a week for one employee. When that's done, we've always done what's called a weekly weighted average. And this is what the federal government has told us to do, and we thought it totally complied with the state law as well. And it does comply with the state general overtime law. And there you take the total gross earnings divided by the number of hours worked during the week and take half of that, and that's the half-time extra that you pay for any hours over 40. We also applied those to the daily hours in times past. Bully has said, no, you need to every day when there is an over an eight-hour day, which we do work a five-day week, so we're on a five-eights type schedule. Every day where there is a daily overtime hour that's assessed, we have to do a daily average and come up with that amount and apply it. Now, the problem comes into, and Bowley says if you do that and then you go through all the computations, they have stated repeatedly that you should be in compliance with both state and federal law. That's what they said, at least in 2000. Last year, they told us, no, you don't have to comply with that state law. And we asked them in return, would you please cite that where we're exempt? They said it's prevailing wage and you don't need to, but we asked them specifically to come back and cite that and actually brought up statutes that require that whenever the law can be interpreted, or needs to, whenever there's more than one law that might apply, it needs to be interpreted, if at all possible, to make all of them effective. And that could have been done if they'd applied weekly weighted average. It's been over a year since our last letter to them asking for that explanation. We have still not received a response. And it was sent by certified mail, so we know they got it. Along with not being compatible with federal law, it's not compatible with the state law. What happens is Bully's been empowered to, by general overtime law, to draft rules that allow up to but not exceeding the payment of 1.5 times the regular rate of pay for overtime over 40 hours. That's the general overtime law. Bully adopted a rule that says employers must pay not less than 1.5 times. So in essence, you must pay equal to. I mean, one law says, well, you're not empowered to adopt rules to require more than. So they adopted one that said you must pay not less than. What happens in the daily, and that's for the 40-hour week, what happens in the daily overtime, you may find that one of those hours in daily overtime paid to more than or paid less than what that 40-hour week average would have come out to. We're now in violation, if that happens, of the state and the federal laws. And this happens quite often in our business. You're probably already getting the gist that daily overtime is a pretty complex issue. And as I go through this, I'm just kind of following the bullets. I presented a 33-page handout, and I'd be glad to read through the whole thing if you'd like. I'm just going to go through these bullets and kind of summarize some thoughts, and I hope I don't miss anything in the process. But Bullies also had problems calculating overtime themselves. We've seen this on two cases against us. One back in 2000, we have four written documents from them wherein they stated the wages owed, including overtime. Each one of those was a different amount. Each one a different amount. They also, in the recent situation I described in the previous hearing, when we went to a mandatory arbitration that wasn't binding, but we went to mandatory arbitration, the complaint that this was based around was the non-payment or the payment of the wrong wage for a classification on prevailing wage job. It amounted to, I think, about a $6,000 claim, $5,000 claim by Bully. However, we found that even if their classification was correct, we would only owe $3,000 or something like that. Ms. Darby had actually presented this prior to this arbitration hearing, had presented the numbers showing this is what it would be. Bully had already done their computations by Mr. Rogers, a compliance specialist, and they were grossly in error. Ms. Bonahaney, Mr. Rogers' supervisor, a compliance specialist also, who should, I would think, certainly know how to do all this sort of thing, this methodology. In the hearing, in front of the arbiter, presented her own numbers. The Department of Justice attorney for Bowley repeatedly questioned Ms. Darby, trying to get her to change her numbers. And finally, he succumbed to accepting them as those are the right numbers. Bowley couldn't even compute it accurately. Repeatedly or consistently. There's also no known software out there that computes this stuff. There's nothing out there. There is that will do the weekly weighted average. We were using it. ADP does it. They do it automatically. We had to spend, I forget, weeks, I know, developing a spreadsheet finally once Bully started enforcing this against us in 2000. And to me, to our knowledge, there's only one other party that they've enforced this daily weighted average against that I found in the state, but I certainly have not surveyed everybody out there. But the lack of software creates a major burden. for this computation. There's also an issue over why is daily weighted or daily overtime a requirement only on public works construction, and yet private construction is just subject to the 40-hour. Why are we required to go through this administrative burden of doing all this extra computation? It doesn't make sense. Why is one group of contractors, or even within ourselves, one contractor, required to comply with two different sets of laws? It's not real conducive to efficient operations. Eliminating daily overtime would also enhance the ability of employees to have more flexible work time. One of the key reasons the federal government repealed it was just that. They found that it was rather burdensome. Employees wanted very flexible type work hours, be able to work a 10-hour or 12-hour day and maybe fewer days in the week, etc. Or to get the job done, the employer wanted to have a 12-hour day this day, but then give them shorter time tomorrow. We got a concrete pour one day, but not the next day. Those kind of situations come up. So by eliminating daily overtime, we would significantly add to the satisfaction of the employees while also significantly adding to the efficiency of everybody's operation. A happy employee is a more efficient employee. An easier scheduling situation is a more efficient operation. Currently, there is the option to work 10-hour days. However, a contractor must choose, and he can't keep changing. It says in the law that says that you either pick 5/8 or 4/10 as your work schedule. 4/10 meaning 4 10-hour days, 5/8, 5 8-hour days. And it says if you go to change, it must be with the intent that it's permanent. So that's not really anything flexible as far as giving us any options. Boley has had trouble teaching this. Not only have they had trouble calculating it, but they've had trouble teaching it. When it's been asked in front of in seminars for them to address it, they've pretty much said it's so complex and timely, we won't do it here. It's on the side or something to that effect. Also, daily overtime provides a discriminatory, a bias towards, a potential bias anyhow, towards anybody that is subject to a collective bargaining agreement, because they can opt out. They don't have to have it. Well, in public works construction, it's pretty much low bidder gets the job. And if you can shave even a small fraction off your costs, you may very well get the job. If that person or that company is getting the job and the other company that can't do that doesn't get the job, not only that company that doesn't get the job, but its employees have been discriminated against. There's no equal employment out there. That's unfair. Cost-wise, the administration, we've estimated, and it's really hard to say what it costs to just deal with daily overtime, but we've estimated it runs about 0.4% of our payroll costs. Now, to a small company, that may not seem a lot, but yet it means we're working somewhere probably between 2 to 4 weeks a year for dealing just with this, just to generate enough profit to pay for this. There isn't a lot of profit in construction or in most any business. I mean, you run some tight lines. Anyway, if you projected that out, and the only way I could find some numbers to use to what total public works construction there is out there is in the Boley publication that comes out every 6 months. There is an estimated number of hours and whatnot in there, and I use that and plug in a dollar amount, and I just guess that there's probably somewhere over $2.5 billion worth of public works payroll annually in the state. I might be wrong, but that's the best I could come up with. At 0.4%, we're talking $10 million a year. We're talking another school or two. That's pretty significant. And all for what? The payback to employees, there might be some pluses or minuses there, and maybe it's more plus. My numbers would say it doesn't even approach $10 million in this whole state. That doesn't seem like a very efficient or effective system if it costs that much to provide a little bit of cash in some employees' pockets. There's got to be a better way. Okay. Repeal would make it compatible.
with state and federal. It would get rid of the burden. Please consider this. The governor promised to make this state more business friendly. That's what this bill would do. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Darby, did you? You're just there to answer
the
question. Okay. Any questions?
Yeah.
Representative Shoffman.
Is there software for the federal rate? Is there software for the federal rate?
Yes. The federal is the same as the general overtime. It's all greater than 40 hour. And as I said, ADP actually was doing that for us. They can do the weekly weighted average and compute that.
I guess, was there software before for the federal rate when it was?
Not to my knowledge. We're talking 20 years ago that computers weren't even in most people's offices then.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony. Oh, Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious how many employees you have.
Chair Brown, Representative Holby. We have, it runs in the 20s. We're in the low 20s right now, typically.
Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Steve Lanning and Dan Gardner and Joe Schaefer again.
Want me to say something about it. Mr. Chair, also, I want to submit Mary Botkin from AFSCME asked me to submit this testimony to this bill. And I said I would also point out that if this passed, it says here it would have a negative effect on the most vulnerable individuals in the workforce. And according to this testimony and the reading of this bill, it is our understanding that this bill would affect those individuals who are employed through a qualified rehabilitation facility. I don't know if the Bureau of Labor Industries wants to comment on that, but I just thought I'd throw it out there.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, sir.
We'll start with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. First, let me comment a little bit on Mr. Schneider's situation. Testimony here. This is a situation I'm not extremely familiar with, I must add, because it happened before I became Labor Commissioner. As far as his particular situation, I'd be more than happy to sit down and talk with him at any time about it. As far as the calculating the daily average, we put out a publication called the Prevailing Wage Book. There is an entire section that outlays exactly how to do that. We do put on seminars, and they do know how to teach exactly how to do that. I will say that this, particularly with this situation, if you look at the actual bill, for his situation, it is an extreme measure on the bill to repeal the entire concept of the 8-hour workday and the 5-hour work week, and to remove overtime provisions beyond 8 hours in a day or 4-10s, as was added in the law in, I believe it was the 99 session when we added 4-10s for a work shift, which is normal in construction, is either 5-8s or 4-10s. And to take away overtime for Saturdays, Sundays, Christmas, New Year's, Thanksgiving, those are all effects of this particular bill. And I really think that his situation, as I said, I'd be more than happy to sit down and discuss it, see what's going on with this particular situation. This particular bill, though, is a pretty expansive change in the entire concept of labor law and in the entire concept of the 5-hour work day and overtime on Saturdays, Sundays, and holidays. It's an extreme measure, and I'd urge your voting no on this particular bill.
Mr. Gardner, are we anywhere near getting software for these folks? I sympathize with people struggling through this. It is complex. I will say this, too. When I was in the union, if I had over 40 and it was on a Sunday and it was a holiday, I made out like a bandit. And when I was in the union, I'd much rather have 8 hours a day and then everything after that overtime. Just for the record, I wanted to throw that out there. But where are we anywhere near? And then we have these surveys and all this stuff. Are we anywhere near coming to offering a software for folks to do that, to figure this out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, software for calculating the average weighted weekly.
Yes, sir. They could just put the data in and spits it out.
I am not aware of a particular software program that's out there on that. We can certainly look into what it would take to set up such a thing.
I think that'd be a good idea.
I've just never had anybody ask me before.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gardner, Mr. Schneider made reference to union contracts allowing union contractors to not pay overtime. I think that's what I was getting to that, and that was unfair to contractors that have to comply to the ORS 279. Are you aware of any union contracts that pay less overtime than what's in 279?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holley, no, I'm not. Matter of fact, the union contracts I'm aware of are much stronger than what is in 279.
Thank you.
And these statutes in 279 apply just to public works contracts, is that?
Mr. Chair, as far as the actual bill, this only applies to public works contracts, Mr. Chair, yes.
Do the existing statutes, are they the same way?
The existing statutes, for instance, for manufacturing, the 10-hour workday is in statute, and Saturdays and Sundays and holidays are as well, is my understanding, Mr. Chair, yes.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, Joe, we'll go to you now, please.
Again, I'm Joe Schaefer. I work for the SEIU Local 503. And most Americans believe in the 8-hour workday. I think that's something that a lot of us believe in. But not so long ago, businesses in this state were able to change the rule to only pay overtime for hours over 10 worked in a day. So we've already weakened the standard in the last few sessions. Now, this measure goes and takes a much bigger second bite at the apple and getting rid of daily overtime altogether and holidays as well. And just for the record, I'd like to say that it's un-American to take Independence Day off the list of holidays that we pay for our employees. So other than that, that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Steve.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Lanning. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We represent 180,000 union members in the state. This bill is, we're obviously opposed to this bill. It's a significant rollback in overtime on public contracts. And what we're talking about here is, bottom line, less wages in workers' paychecks. When you look at the change that it's proposing, and you look at the number of days and holidays and Sundays, it's significant. And we're not in support of it, obviously. And I'll just end with this. Yesterday, when we put out our legislative newsletter about what's going on this week at the Capitol, the title of the story surrounding this bill said, "Not even Scrooge would support this overtime rollback." Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on 2476? Jessica's shaking her head no. Okay. Then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2476. And, Janet, nothing else? Everybody here bright and early, bushy tail?
Yeah. All right. What time tomorrow?
We're adjourned.